First case this morning is United States against Mullins. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Major Anthony Burgos, and I represent the appellant in this case, Petty Officer First Class Russell Mullins. Chief Judge F. Fawn, with court permission, I ought to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
Credibility was a critical issue at trial, as is frequently the case with charges such as those that appellant was charged with and as were similar to the facts contained in Brooks. As in Brooks, the impermissible human lie detector testimony secured appellant's conviction at trial because the testimony went to the core issue of the victim's credibility and truthfulness. Specifically, the expert witness's testimony that false allegations occur in 1 in 100 and even 1 in 200 cases a year spoke directly to the victim's, the alleged victim's credibility and truthfulness.
Can you be clear what the precise error was here? Was it the failure of the judge to sui sponte give a second corrective instruction?
Yes, sir. Well, specifically, the corrective instruction, the first instruction that the military judge gave didn't even address this specific mathematical, the statistics evidence that the expert witness described. If the court can recall, the military judge's instructions, he first started off with members, you know, this is the testimony you just heard. In other words, he was instructing the members on an instruction.
Didn't the statistics come after the curative instruction?
Yes, Your Honor.
It would be a little hard for him to address it in the curative instruction. That hasn't occurred yet.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So is it your claim then that what the error was not, you have the characteristics of children, then he gives an instruction, then you have the numeric, and is it your view, I'm trying to isolate what the real error here is, and the error then is not to give the curative instruction again?
Yes, sir. The military judge should have, in light of the danger of this type of this statistical information, the military judge should have sua sponte, again, informed the members in very clear, precise terms, not through cross-examination, not through some follow-up question. Members, you are to disregard the information you've just heard.
Have we held that in any previous case?
No, Your Honor, we have not.
Okay. Why didn't the question he gave after it, in which he elicited the fact that the only way you can know is if somebody confesses, cure any remaining problem?
Well, first, Your Honor, those follow-up questions don't amount to an instruction. If anything, it confused the members. It was not a clear, concise, timely instruction to the members. You are not to
You consider- just had a clear, concise, timely instruction.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
They had just had a clear, concise, timely instruction, had they not?
Yes, sir. Concerning the testimony they had just heard, and yet on the heels of that, some really, you know, prejudicial information comes before the members, and they're free to, as far as the members are concerned, they're free to consider this. It's, again, in putting yourself in the member's seat, you're not really clear what you're supposed to do with this information. The military judge never specifically told the members, you are not to consider this information for any purpose.
Well, now, this is literally minutes later, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what about the instruction that the corrective instruction they had just received fails to alert them to the dilemma and problems with the numeric information they then received? Is it your view that the instruction's fine, it just didn't come after the offending language?
Perhaps it would be fine, sir, but it's still somewhat equivocal in the instruction. Not necessarily equivocal, but it was in very specific. On the instructions to the members.
Yeah, he said you don't use it. He said you don't use it for any purpose. What more can he say?
Hang on, why don't you answer the question? Read the instruction and tell us what was missing from it, if you would, please. Because you have the temporal argument, which is it should have come after, but then you're also making the argument that the instruction is not adequate in any event. On 654, I believe that he is the instruction question.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, specifically, when the military judge says, before I begin cross-examination, members, I'm going to give you an instruction at this time concerning the testimony you've just heard. So as far as the members are concerned, Your Honor, they will be under the impression that, well, anything that comes thereafter is permissible. And until the military judge tells me to do otherwise, I am free to consider it. And so these follow-up questions that the military judge, this colloquy he has with the expert witness, served no purpose other than to perhaps confuse the members. In fact, he had to restate the question to the.
Now go on to the next line, the next two paragraphs of the instructions.
Oh, yes, sir.
Is there something wrong with that instruction other than it didn't occur after the 1 in 100 and 1 in 200?
Counsel, could you please identify what page of the record you're referring to now, what page of the joint appendix?
Appellant's brief, page 16, Your Honor, and this is record 653-54, joint appendix 117-118, where the military judge describes that. On its face, Your Honor, addressing the question, the human lie detector testimony, instruction he gave to the members aren't necessarily deficient. However, when viewed in the fact, when the specifics of this information came out, they were tap dancing around the issue before that. If the court can recall, the reason the military judge said that, gave this instruction, was as a result of a member's question asking about false allegations in general terms. And of course, she said, well, they occur, and she said they occur rarely. And so, obviously, perhaps the military judge took issue with this, perhaps the testimony, and made the instruction. But what was even more damaging and more goes more to the heart of credibility of the victims comes out when she says the 1 in 100, 1 in 200 numbers. Again, the military judge did not instruct the members to directly disregard that. I mean, this is...
Well, counsel, did the military judge instruct the members to disregard any specific testimony? I don't see that on the pages that you're referring to. So I'm trying to figure out whether this is a curative instruction with respect to anything. On page 118 of the joint appendix, the military judge talks generally about credibility, and then he says, to the extent you believe this witness testimony says or implies that the alleged victim's account of the alleged acts are credible, you may not consider this as evidence that a crime has occurred. He's talking there about the member's belief. Did the military judge at any point identify any specific evidence in the record and tell the members to disregard that?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Viewed this evidence, the statistical evidence that was presented before the members, viewed it in the context of the entire trial, it was definitely pivotal and really required for the government, obviously, for the members to believe the victims. This tipped the scales in the government's favor, the statistical evidence, and again, in light of all the evidence that was put forth for the members, the weak government case. Ultimately, the victims had to be believed by the members if a conviction was to be secured by the government. Specifically, the lower court and the government pointed out that the government's case was a strong one where it was overwhelming and otherwise clear that the members saw fit to convict the appellant because he was clearly guilty. However, viewed in the context of all the facts, it was a contentious, very heated custody battle with the children.
How would you describe the state of the law as to human lie detector testimony at the time the trial occurred?
Well, at the time the trial occurred, military judges, trial attorney, everybody was on notice that the limits at which human lie detector testimony, or at least the type of evidence that...
I'm really talking about case law.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Case law.
Yes, Your Honor. The state of the case law, we're talking about Casper and Birdsall, Your Honor, where, again, practitioners should know what are the limits of what expert witnesses are allowed to testify to. And she crossed that line when she brought out the numbers.
Did those cases hold that numerical testimony was per se inadmissible?
No, Your Honor.
That was later, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, a plain reading of some of these opinions, again, talking about they discussed the limitations of MRA 608, the evidence of truthful character. I mean, there are certain limits, obviously, that courts, trial courts, were sufficiently on notice in what the type of testimony is permissible. Again, viewed in light of some of the evidence or the government's case, this statistical evidence, again, pointed to the victim's credibility and certainly played a significant pivotal role in the court-martial. There were many contradictions, although the lower court pointed to that the victims were consistent and they corroborated each other's testimony. Reading of the record reveals otherwise. There were a lot of inconsistencies. And again, the members were able to refer back to those numbers in deciding on whether or not who to believe. I would just point out a few that the members were presented with evidence from the victims that were ultimately somewhat confusing and not necessarily consistent.
Are you arguing factual sufficiency before us?
No, Your Honor, I'm not. However, the lower court and the government pointed out that the government's case, there was no prejudice because the government's case was so strong and so compelling. It's Appellant's position that nothing can be further from the truth. And so because credibility was a main factor, a deciding factor in Brooks, Appellant's position is that, similar to Brooks, credibility played a pivotal role in this case. Ultimately, as in Brooks, this court cannot say that the members were not impermissibly swayed by the impermissible human lie detector testimony. This error violated appellant's substantial right to have the members decide the ultimate issue without the members viewing the victim's credibility through the filter of the expert. Appellant respectfully asks this court to set aside the charges in this case under assignment of error one. Moving on to, if there are no further questions to the first assignment of error, I will continue with the second assignment of error. As to the second assignment of error, appellant was denied due process by excessive post-trial delay in this case. Appellant has demonstrated economic prejudice and has had to register as a sex offender in the state of California for his Article 120, 125, and 134 offenses. Due to the meritorious issues in appellant's case, he would not have been subjected to registration or oppressive incarceration had the government processed his appeal in a more timely fashion.
If we disagree with you that the first issue that you've raised is meritorious, do you agree that you don't have a due process violation? Or do you agree that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt with respect to the post-trial delay?
If we lose on the first assignment, Your Honor,
under Bush.
If I might answer that question on rebuttal, Your Honor.
Sure.
Thank you. Viewed in the context of the timeline of the appellant's case, it took the appellant defense counsel for the appellant over 448 days to contact the appellant. That just basically set the stage for what was to be a long and arduous process thereafter. Appellant would just point out the timelines and the prejudices experienced in this case, and would ask that this court set aside with prejudice, or in the alternative, offers a relief under, as was issued in Moreno, where the court could authorize a remand but limit punishment as this court did in Moreno. No further questions. That concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. You will have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the governor.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Brian Keller. Along with Colonel Louis Puglio, I represent the United States. I'd like to discuss 4 points today. First, that there was no error. Second, that any error was not plain given the state of law at the time of trial. Third, even if the error was plain, any error was harmless. And fourth, given the lack of prejudice and the lower court's findings as to the reasons of the delay, no relief is merited for post-trial delay. With regard
to arguing in the alternative there, what's the core of your argument? If you were going to pick one and say, I'm going to win or lose this case on the following, Because you're just doing chick, 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 chick. Well, if I lose that, then this. If I lose that, then this.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it the government's view? X.
Well, I don't think it's... I think they're all true. And I think that one, that there's no error. So I disagree with...
So it's just, saying it's permissible testimony to say 1 in 200 chance this person's lying, or it's no error because it was cured?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. If it was, there's a
I was
one
asking you alternatives, so I can't be right.
I heard the first part of your question. Your Honor, I think it's both. You know, 1 in 100 chance that this person is lying, if that's what was testified to, that absolutely would be error. I think the problem here, I think if law of the case is applied, obviously we can't get over this. But the reason law of the case shouldn't be applied, I think looking back to Parker, if the government simply had no incentive to appeal this, it was an unpublished case. It was a case where the government had prevailed. There was no point for the government to appeal this case. However, if this court disagrees and finds that the error was plain, let's say the court disagrees with the analysis of whether there's plain error, and says the plain error is analyzed as of the time of appeal, and they disagree that there's prejudice, then we're left with the error issue. Second, I think that it's useful to analyze whether there's error or not, simply because you've got Brooks and you've got Mari, which fairly summarily decide that there is error or that there's plain error, and I don't think give the practitioner a good idea of what exactly is going on behind the scenes. This is not, as Judge Baker, the words you use, which is that this person is a 1 in 100% chance this person is telling the truth. Instead, it was about 1 out of 100, 1 out of 200 were these false reporting. That's the statistic I know.
Would it be a fair inference that one might say, well, then this is a person who fits that category, therefore perhaps there's a 1 in 200 chance this person's lying?
Well, that's the exact, no, it could be in some cases. That's the exact leap that you can't do and that the judge recognized here after the consistency testimony. It's okay to say that I see these issues with people who have been abused and I find that this person is consistent with that. It's not okay to say that I've seen 1 in 100 cases that are false reporting, but I see that this person also falls into that category. So I think there's something going on behind the scenes in both Brooks and Mari that the court could take an opportunity to clarify here, which is a contextual
what's
test.
What's not clear about statistics that serve as a proxy for a lie detector test, and you can't use statistics.
Is that from Brooks, Your Honor?
I mean, what's not clear about the case law on that point?
Are you saying Brooks, Your Honor? Because if that's Brooks, then Brooks says that percentage testimony implicates that issue where testimony can intrude upon a credibility determination. But it can't be the case that per se, every time you elicit percentage testimony, that intrudes upon that credibility, and certainly not in this case. I think what's appropriate is a factor test, and that would be, what was the testimony? Was it statistic testimony that said, I've seen 1 in 100 cases, 1 in 100 cases out there, number one, or was it that there's a 1 in 100 chance that this person's telling the truth or not? Second,
you're trying to shade this along the lines that is probably more difficult for you than to address the third point that you made, which is that even if it was error and even if it was plain, it was cured.
Oh, absolutely.
So the question, I guess, is I thought Judge Baker was asking you which was your strongest argument in a different way, and you want us to decide everything for you instead of picking your strongest argument and making it.
Well, I think that if this court finds there's no error, that's not a problem. I'm happy to move on to the prejudice argument if that's what you'd like to hear, Your Honor. I think that there was also no prejudice. I think that's absolutely right.
But is that a weaker argument than your no error argument? I think that's the question. They asked argument.
Right. I think if there's no error, then this is disposed of immediately. If this court says, let's take the opportunity to look at Mari and look at
it's
Brooks.
It's obvious that if there's no error, there's no error. But we're asking you, What's your best argument? If we said, you're only allowed to make one argument today, thanks for coming, but new rules, one argument only. You can pick no error, error but cured, error not cured but not prejudicial, or thank you, we wish we weren't here.
I would almost never demur to your question, Your Honor, and so that's not this case, but that isn't this case. I mean, there's no error, number one, and number two, it's not plain. because in this case, at the time of trial, you just had Mary, and then you had Casey, which said that it's okay to make a direct comment about credibility.
But you're assuming that we're stuck with the law at the time of the trial. And my recollection is that the majority of this court in Harkrow said no, in accordance with Supreme Court precedent, we apply here the law as it is today, not the law at the time of the trial.
That is exactly what the defense argued, Your Honor. I think that's
well, that's correct. Exactly what this court said, counsel.
That is not what the government reads the case law to say.
And that's what Harkrow concluded.
What did Harkrow
well,
say?
I think that's a selective, and I don't.
Well, remember, it's what a court and we wrote the opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
But counsel, I would like to hear what counsel has to say about Harkrow, because Harkrow is out there, now belongs to the world, and counsel can tell us what counsel believes Harkrow means.
Yes, Your Honor. Harkrow says, I think quotes from Johnson, which is, you know, if you look at the useful Kaczynski opinion, which talks about the four different situations, if the law is settled at the time of trial and at the time of appeal, it's very different. It's a sea change. It's a totally different situation. Then it's enough that the law is settled at the time of appeal. I think that's exactly what Harkrow cites from. And I think that's the case in Harkrow, because you have a trial that happened, I think, in 2001, 2002. And then you have, and this court itself in Harkrow talks about the fact that the admissibility of testimony was looked at under the rules of evidence solely before that. Afterwards, Crawford came out and completely changed the field. So there was a sea change in the law at that point. I don't think that's at all the case where you have law, and I think these are the four categories, when you have law that is unsettled at the time of trial, and it becomes later settled at the time of appeal. So if there are those four categories, I don't want to devolve into, if this court disagrees, obviously, but I think that's how I read Harkrow, and that's how I read Nieto before that, which is if it's unsettled at the time of trial, and it becomes later settled, then you take the law at the time of trial.
Now, is it true that at the time the standard was that the members should decide whether there is a reasonable doubt or not? Is that fair to say? It's not fair.
Oh, as to the findings, Your Honor? Yeah, I think that hasn't changed for a few years.
You would concur in that statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
If, and this is not what was said, but if the expert had said there's a 1 in 200 chance that this person's not telling the truth, that she was abused, would you agree that that would implicate the concept that members would decide whether there is a reasonable doubt?
Absolutely. That's language from Brooks, and I think that's a direct comment on credibility. That would be a direct comment on this person's credibility.
So that wouldn't be a change in the law?
No, Your Honor. Okay. That would not be a change in the law, and I think that's clear under 608. You can't have a direct comment on credibility. The only question the government has about the error analysis is whether there is a judicially deeming percentage testimony to be a direct comment on this person's credibility.
And why doesn't,
when they're not actually talking about that person?
And why doesn't Traumann-Ellis, for example, which is not directly on point, but does raise the issue about percentage testimony, why does that not put folks on notice that this is an area of concern?
I can't answer that question.
Just because you're not familiar with Traumann-Ellis?
I'm not sure what the quote from that case, right?
Okay.
The law that applies to me.
They both address the question of percentage testimony by experts, but not in the exact context presented here.
Yes, sir. As to the prejudice analysis, I'll jump to the prejudice analysis because I've heard questions about the prejudice analysis. I think that the prejudice analysis also is where the government can win, because there's got to be material prejudice to substantial rights, first of all, or I guess the third point. The fourth point, and fifth, relief also could be denied discretionarily by the court where the error didn't seriously affect the fairness of the trial. And certainly here there was no serious effect on the fairness of the trial. Because there was a fair trial, the testimony wasn't material, it wasn't of high quality, there were the cautionary instructions given up front, the prophylactic instruction given by the judge about the lie detector testimony, first of all. Second, there was the explanatory testimony after the clarifying question by the military judge to say that, no, as a matter of fact, let me split this up. First of all, the witness said up front, I don't really give an opinion about truthfulness anyway. That's not what I do. I just talk to the witness. So the witness knew exactly what she was talking about and said that before the members. Second of all, there was the clarifying explanation by the witness where the witness said, no, there's no way of me knowing anyway. I have no scientific way of knowing that or not. I don't make any opinion about the... So that she came back to what she had said up front. So that was clarified, and there was no materiality or quality to the evidence for that reason. There's also that the defense used this in its closing. They used the fact that the witness had said, yes, as a matter of fact, I've had one false case. One case that came back that was later false. The defense then used this in its closing. And I think this relates in some part to Maz, even though I understand that that was an IAC case. But it also relates to the other cases where the judge has said, for instance, in Casey, that the door has been opened. Interesting, of course, in Casey, because they said that there was error, but that it's okay because the door was open. Well, and the same thing here, I think. The defense's theory was coaching, and the defense then used that later on. And this harkens back, of course, to the government's argument that there was no error. It doesn't open the door for saying, yes, as a matter of fact, this person's been telling the truth. But if this court does engage in a contextual analysis to find out whether percentage testimony is going to be error or not, it opens the door for saying, yes, perhaps this testimony was not a direct comment on credibility. Because, again, the government doesn't believe that that's what the case law says. As to whether there was plain error or not, the government, of course, believes that the field was unsettled at the time of trial. There was, and I think that the Court of Criminal Appeals points this out when they say that the two cases that this court cites to in Brooks were Powell and the federal case. Of course, the federal case, Ridded, was a direct comment on credibility. The other case, Powell, was the state case that cites to a plain error test that is a different plain error test than this court uses. They use plain to incorporate the prejudice prong. So they say, we look to see whether there's prejudice or not, and that tells us whether it's plain or not. So the government also believes there's no plain error.
Counsel, to follow up on your earlier discussion of Hargrove, trying to figure out why there would be a difference in the two types of cases that you described, and this is an area of law that is challenging, but if you have a situation in which, as you've described it, at the time of trial, the judge did not err, either because the case law was clear in a particular direction or it was unsettled in a particular direction, why does that make any difference once the case goes forward? That is, if the judge didn't err, but on appeal, it's clear that the judge's ruling is inconsistent with law, putting aside your no-error argument. Why should it make any difference what the state of the law was at the time of the trial if the judge didn't err at that time? And yet we're still going to find plain error based on what went on in appeal. I'm not clear as to why there should be a distinction.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's extremely complex area, too. And if the government saw the difference between the two cases yet on Harkov, if this court disagrees, obviously this is the court that makes the rules, the law. The justification that the government has found in the case law talking about plain error, where it's unsettled, of the two, unsettled and then settled, and then settled one way, pre-Crawford, and settled another way afterwards, the other direction, Crawford, is because prior to, I think the justification that's been given is because at the time of trial, then if it's settled, it would have been futile for the counsel to object as to on that grounds. Whereas here, I think because there were cases like that out there, Powell, because there was Mari, which doesn't talk about percentage testimony, but does talk about deeming testimony to be a comment on credibility, that judicially deeming one thing to be another, direct to be none, or non-direct to be direct. There was case law out there where the counsel could have stood up and said, I object. This percentage testimony, even though it's talking about outlier cases, which she says don't apply to this case, I don't need opinions on truthfulness, and she later says, I this doesn't really even apply anyway to my analysis in her explanatory comment. There was case law out there where defense counsel could have stood up and said, I object. This testimony is inadmissible. And it's clear here, of course, that the military judge did know what the state of the law, well, he thought he knew what the state of the law was, because he said, because he clearly, he rejected the testimony about why did you find this person believable. Both counsel objected to that, and it was not let in. Contrast that, of course, to Brooks, where if you look at the CCA's opinion, the counsel did stand, I'm sorry, the witness said, I find this person to be credible. And the judge said disregard that, gave no prophylactic instruction as in this case. Here, of course, the judge let the consistency testimony in, which is permissible, and then gave a prophylactic instruction to make sure that they didn't infer anything from it, because I think he understood, or it's apparent to the government that he understood, that's what the bounds of the case law at the time were.
So in terms of the case law at the time, what cases would stand for the contrary proposition, that is, that this evidence was admissible?
Well, I think that there was Casey, I believe, where they said, and again, that was fairly unclear to the government, at least, because it said that the door was opened by the defense talking about the credibility issue.
Right. So doesn't a door opening case typically stand for the opposite proposition, that evidence was inadmissible, but it nonetheless came in?
The government, it said that it was error, but it was harmless because the door was open.
Yeah,
perhaps so, Your Honor.
So that would appear to cut the other way. That is, that would appear to cut to the inadmissible and therefore error concept.
Perhaps so. The government interpreted that to mean that this is the case where you find that it's the court says that it's a functional equivalent in this case, where the government, where the defense has talked about it before. Not that it's 608, but that it's a functional equivalent, was how the government interpreted that. And of course, that's what Marlin cited to in his 2006 opinion, the Casey case. Mari, of course, found further that it was harmless beyond reasonable doubt in a similar situation. So that is another way that the government can win, because it is, in this case, also harmless beyond reasonable doubt.
I'm only talking about the error aspect, that is, the stay of the law at the time.
Yes, sir.
What you've indicated is that the stay of the law at the time may well have established that it was error to let this testimony in.
The government's contention is that it was not clear that it was error at the time that it could come in. That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Right, and my question was, what case stands for the opposite proposition, and we haven't identified one yet, that is a proposition that this evidence was affirmatively admissible?
Well, I don't think there's a statement. I don't think there's case law out there that necessarily says this. I think there may be some cases in our, not military cases, but there are cases, I think, in our brief where we say that it goes the other way. This court, of course, cited to Powell, which was a state case with a different plain error test, and it cited to Witted, which was direct testimony. There's also, I think, the Colorado case. There's a California Reporter case. I think Evans is the case where they said that it was not plain error because the victim testified that they were vigorously cross-examined. They testified as a lay witness. So I think the government's contention is that we don't think that it's error, but also we don't think that it's clear that it's plain error at the time.
Right. But do any of those cases that you cited stand? I was just trying to figure out where we stand in the range here. Do any of those cases stand for the proposition that testimony as to a percentage of likelihood of truth or falsity was admissible? Which of those cases stand for that proposition?
I don't think those cases do, Your Honor. I think
that answers my question.
It's collapsing my mind now. I think that there's a case that's in our brief that actually stands for that proposition. I don't recall what it is.
Okay.
I think Skidmore is one federal case, which is granted a civil case, but it's applying rules of evidence. And that federal case predates trial. It was extant law at the time of trial. And they said that the testimony that I didn't feel like I was duped by the witness was permissible because it did not, even though that kind of testimony can intrude on the credibility determination, that did not directly intrude on the credibility determination. And I think the government believed that the language in Brooks, which was that this implicates a credibility determination, means that, yes, there are cases when they can. Certainly in Brooks, that was a case where at trial there was direct testimony that I find this person credible. That did not happen here. This is a very different case. There was no direct testimony about that.
I don't need to belabor the point, but I know that three different judges have asked you this question. You've declined to answer any of us. Of your three arguments, one, that it was perfectly permissible for this testimony to come in. Two, that even if it wasn't, if the error wasn't plain and obvious because your reading of Harpo is correct. Or three, even if those two arguments fail, that there was no prejudice to substantial rights. Which of those three is your strongest argument? You have to pick one, and I'm asking you to pick one.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, you don't have to answer that in 7 seconds. You can take the reasonable time necessary to answer that.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, if I have to pick one, then we'll pick the third argument, that there is no prejudice. I think that it is easy to show that it is harmless in this case.
I have a question about issue two.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's stipulate for the purpose of the question, but not for the case, that the appellant prevails on all three factors until you get to prejudice. And the only issue in this case, there's no human lie detector issue. The only issue is ADP. And what would it take for an appellant to, in the government's view, satisfactorily demonstrate economic prejudice in the form of denial of unemployment? Putting aside, I'm not asking you what California law is. I'm asking you, what would demonstrate economic prejudice in that context, if anything?
I think that Bush establishes we need some kind of extrinsic evidence that he would have been given a job or he would have been given unemployment. Not going to the California issue, but that he would have been given unemployment benefits.
So an affidavit from an appropriate authorized official saying, but for that,
I think that
I'm just trying to, because it's important that if we're going to have this case law, that people understand what the hurdle is, rather than move the hurdle around so nobody knows when to jump.
Yes, sir.
So it is the government's view that, understanding this is an abstract question, if there were an affidavit in the record from an authorized official who administered the unemployment insurance or whatever, that would satisfy the government that there was prejudice, provided all the other factors were weighed in and all that.
It's got to be more than speculative.
Right. But for this X, you would, the government would say that would demonstrate.
Instead of what the government understands to be the state of the record, which is that there's a document in the record saying that, well, we're not taking your application because,
To be very clear, I wasn't saying that's what the record is.
Yes,
it's an abstract question. I just want to know what the hurdle might look like in the government's view.
There's got to be something more than speculative affidavit in the record, Your Honor.
If you'd like to take the opportunity, you may make a brief closing statement.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government asks that this court find dispose of law of the case and find that no error occurred and establish a contextual analysis of when percentage testimony can be applied to given testimony or evidence. Second of all, that the government overall asks that this court affirm its findings and sentence in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Judge Ryan, I think I have an answer for you. If I could, going to the specific, you referenced Bush in relation to, if I could get a clarification on the question, Your Honor.
My question was, do you agree that if you do not prevail on the first issue, that you lose on the second issue?
Well, appellant, the evidence that's before this court through his affidavits trying to assert the economic prejudice and based on the last questions from towards the government, we're talking about the economic prejudice that the appellant has experienced. Appellant has basically tried to put forth as much information he can to assert that he in fact did experience economic prejudice. Without more than the affidavits, unfortunately, there's nothing before this court.
So the short declaratory answer to the question was, you do not lose, or you do lose?
Well, we believe we win, Your Honor.
Surprise, surprise.
I tried to delay that answer, sir. No, I believe we win just on the facts. The inordinate amount of time that has passed, and it's a post-trial delay in this case. The actions of the lower court essentially not addressing and, in fact, blaming the appellant in the post-trial delay, never addressing this court's mandate, much less even investigating the court's mandate to investigate the IAC in the case, the ineffective assistance of counsel. I mean, there's a whole host of reasons.
What case stands for the proposition that if you lose on the first substantive issue, you can win on the second issue simply by showing economic prejudice in the delay?
I cannot cite a case, Your Honor.
Then how do you win? Are we supposed to overrule any past cases? Are you asking? You haven't asked us to do that.
No, Your Honor.
Then how do you win?
I would point to other forms of relief that this court has provided in the past. For example, like in Toohey and in Jones and some of those other cases that there was post-trial delay. But again, the appellant has pointed to not just only post-trial delay, but also the other issues, constitutional anxiety, having to register as a sex offender. The passage of time, certainly if there's a retrial or a remand and a retrial, the evidence, the passage of time, erodes memories. And then there's a whole host of other reasons why the post-trial delay implicates and reflects poorly on the system as a whole that his due process was not handed out to the appellant. If there are further questions, that concludes my argument. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The court, the case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 10:20 a.m.
All rise.